Let me take the privilege as chairman to ask you a question. Building on what, if I properly understood you, Nicolas, you were saying, namely that this is not yet the time to reconsider our strategy. When would be the time to reconsider the strategy? After all, Iran is proceeding with enrichment. The construction of its facilities proceeds. Does there come a moment when we need to reconsider what is our strategic approach on this matter? There are, of course, some who would say that there are some red line that may be crossed when Iran would achieve capabilities that would let it quickly build nuclear weapons if it's so minded. There are others who would say that when Iran has proceeded so far with its facilities, we are simply going to have to accept the reality that Iran does have an enrichment capability and change what is our position. But I would like to ask you, what would be the time? What would show that the time had come that it was necessary to reconsider our strategy? And could I ask you to answer using these microphones?
Shall I try to answer that difficult question by first saying that I don't see any reason or any time at which we would change the objective. And this remains the key point. The objective, as I mentioned, is to try to regain confidence in what the Iranians are doing. And I don't see any circumstances under which we should reconsider that very core principle and that very key objective. Then the other element of your question is, can we reconsider at a certain time how we integrate those various tools that we have at our disposal, i.e. sanctions, negotiation? I don't know. I don't know, but I won't enter, especially in public, a discussion on the timelines. The Iranians are developing a program, and there's a continuous line from a purely technical standpoint. Many speak about red lines or points of no return. We have never used that kind of terminology. And each day, the Iranians are making progress towards an objective that we don't know, but on which we have strong doubts. And each day, we will consider what we are doing. But I would not enter, especially publicly, any kind of discussion on the time at which we should reconsider everything. And once again, for the very basic element, the very basic principle that the objective that we are pursuing will remain the same throughout the time.
I would agree with Nicola, and I just would like to remind us of the situation which we were before some time ago when we had the things still in the IEA. I believe nobody at that time would have thought that we would get to the United Nations Security Council. And when we had it in the United Nations Security Council, nobody would have thought we'd really get a Security Council resolution. Everybody had North Korea in its mind, and that won't work out. And we have achieved a lot so far, which nobody would have predicted at that time. So I think it's very difficult to make predictions now. And whether it's useful, I believe Nicolas has already given an answer to that. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Well, I see a few hands up. Please do wait for the mic.
Stand on me, Financial Times. I'm afraid I would like to press you a little bit on what Patrick asked you. You say you won't enter timelines, but the EU effort has been going on since 2003. The EU offer was made in mid-2005, then remade in mid-2006. Sanctions have been in place for about 18 months. And during the last 2 years, Iran has really stepped up its enrichment activities. Are you not concerned that there's a limited time for diplomacy and that Iran is getting ever closer to the breakout capacity about which you talk? Many people have noted that although the enrichment activity at Natanz is still below capacity, considerably below capacity, it has nonetheless accelerated. Doesn't that put a real focus and importance on 2008? And if you don't stop Iran from getting a breakout capacity in 2008, isn't it likely that it's going to happen in the long term?
I mean, good questions. I think, in simple terms, we don't see 2008 as critical as you said, is. I mean, I sort of echo what my colleagues have said. This is a long-term problem. In one form or other, we've been wrestling with Iran's WMD ambitions for much longer than 4 years. You know, policy on this didn't just start in 2003. It just changed course. I think the way we've approached the problem has evolved significantly since 2003. The way the international community has approached the problem has evolved considerably since 2003. Not least because the US, having initially, I suppose, been a skeptical observer of E3 efforts, became a strong supporter and joined Russia and China and ourselves in trying to pursue this. During that time, we've maintained an international consensus. I think we've done a lot to increase awareness about the problem. We still have a lot of diplomatic tools available to us. We've only pulled a few of those. Like Nicola, I don't want to get in the debate about timelines, but we think that there is still some time to make the current strategy work. We don't believe that Iran has yet mastered the enrichment process. We don't use the term red line, but you know, beyond the mastery of the enrichment process, there are several other steps you can get to before you acquire breakout capabilities. So our determination is to make the current strategy work.
I've been told very seriously not to answer any time any hypothetical question, but let me try to do so. And I understand that you are extremely impatient, and so are we. But let me remind you that history has taught us since 2003 that process can work. We were able, between 2003 and 2005, to create the right international context in which the Iranians were just forced to suspend their enrichment program. So this is not as if all our efforts has been completely unsuccessful since the beginning of our process in 2003. And I don't see at this stage that we are at the end of that road. Definitely not. We have still room for maneuver there. As Neil pointed out, without entering any kind of discussion on the timelines, we are not there yet. And we are not there yet also on the sanctions track and the negotiating track. We still have some room for maneuvers there. So any kind of assessment right now that would say that our efforts have failed would be, unreasonable. We are not there. And we still have efforts to do. And this is exactly what we are engaged in right now and that we will continue to do so.
Right at front, Eli Lake.
This is Eli Lake of the New York Sun. For the panel, in public interviews, Mohammed al-Baradei has suggested that the enrichment in Natanz is not for a nuclear weapons program. Do you think that the director general is Iran's NPT lawyer?
Come now, gentlemen. Don't all rush forward to the podium at once.
Well, I think the Iranians think that they see in him a person that mostly tries to mediate between the Iranians and the E3+3 and the world community. So to answer that question, that is their perspective. And I think he himself feels a kind of responsibility to act as an intermediator to try to establish links and give information to both sides. If that answers your question,
He's contradicted what you just told us, all three of you, about the enrichment activities, how you've seen no reason to believe it's for civilian purposes. He has recently on Wolf Blitzer insisted that there is.
Well, we've given you our assessment of the situation, so there might be different assessments.
We always have to come back to the very simple facts, and the very simple facts are in the IAEA reports that are presented by the Director General of the IAEA at each and every Board of Governors. And in these reports, there are a certain number of sentences on what the Iranians are doing, the outstanding questions that are still on the table. And if I remember correctly, in many reports, you have a certain number of elements which the agency qualifies as, quote-unquote, may have a nuclear military dimension. I'm not inventing anything there. This is in the IAEA reports. And once again, all the answer to these speculations about the objectives, the intentions, are extremely interesting from an intellectual standpoint. But when it comes to defining policies, then we'd better come back to the simple facts. And these facts, once again, are extremely clear and extremely well documented by the IEA itself.
Well, let's move it back, please. Ladies first.
Great. Either way. Okay, Tilin Dalolo with the Washington Times. Thank you. My question is to Neil Crampton. You presented that the rising daily criticism of Ahmadinejad policies and the coming election in March as a sign of hope. Well, my question is, if the nuclear program is this, you know, state of Iran's policy, then why should the elections matter? Or what kind of assurances can the next president give to the international community on the nuclear issue?
The next president of Iran? Okay. Well, that election, of course, is not until the year after next. It's the parliamentary elections that will take place in March. You're right, in a sense, that you put your finger on a conundrum. The regime is very keen to say that its policy is state policy. And indeed, that's a remarkably consistent line you get from anybody you talk to in the regime, including those who currently don't hold office, but are nonetheless influential within the system. But equally, our assessment remains, and it remains important to our policy, that there is a fault line within the system. I think if I were to say, speaking as from the UK perspective, and I'm not quite sure what my French and German colleagues would say, we think that probably a majority of the regime in Tehran is keen to acquire at least the option of a nuclear weapon. But we think that there is a fault line between more pragmatic people and more ideological people. And the more pragmatic people worry more about the costs of the course they're on, and are more inclined to try and negotiate with the international community to try and find a way through international tensions on this issue. That's where we see the fault line. I think before 2005, the fault line, when you looked at the fault line, there were more people on the pragmatic side who favored suspension and negotiation. Since then, the more ideological confrontational strand has enjoyed primacy. But I think that there are, as I said before, an increasing number of people who are fretting about the costs. It may be that the election results strengthen the hands of the pragmatic types, in the same way that the Assembly of Experts elections last December played a modest role in strengthening the hands of the pragmatists in Tehran.
I can't resist injecting a personal comment that as an observer of Iran's scene, I entirely agree with Neil that there is a fault line in the regime. I would say that the one element in the regime believes in spitting in your eye, and that's the confrontational people who we have in power now, while the others believe in blowing smoke in your eyes. And that is Rafsanjani and his crowd, who started this nuclear program and continued it for so many years while lying about what they're doing. So my great concern is that we will return to the days of having smoke blown in our eyes rather than being spit on. It's always a difference, sir.
Peter Crail with the Arms Control Association. Mr. Roche, you mentioned that the recent reports issued by Solana and Mr. Alberadi were both seen as negative. Now, in September, the E3+3 had said that if progress was not seen in these two reports, that there was an understanding that they would move forward on a new sanctions resolution. And I was curious, in the consultations with the E3+3, if the other states involved had also shared your assessment of those reports.
There's another rule I've been taught is not to answer on behalf of other countries. and I will stick to that well. What I can tell you is that I'm not aware that any countries of the P5+1 has has renounced the very principles that our six ministers put together in a piece of paper in September. And as a matter of fact, the six of us are right now negotiating and finalizing precisely that third sanctions resolution. Then the two questions are the substance and the timeline. I don't know. We are exactly in that negotiation. But what I see from the discussions going on is that we are still, the six of us, on that track, and things are moving forward in the right direction. And I don't see any of these six countries jeopardizing the whole negotiation.
So, let's see.
Ariel Cohen, the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, the European unity was indeed impressive, as well as the discipline of the French diplomatic corps. However, if you don't want to talk about red lines or changing strategy, within the existing framework, there are some obvious pressure points. Would any of you like to address them? For example, the newly announced $2 billion petroleum deal with China, the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline that is moving along, and the fact that Iran is importing 40% of its gasoline, and there were already gasoline riots that made the regime extremely uncomfortable, up to including shooting people in Tehran. Would you address all three of these particular pressure points? How do you view them? And maybe suggest additional directions to sanctions, whether in the framework of the UN Security Council negotiations or the EU, US, possibly EU, US, Japan cooperation, especially targeting the Iranian petroleum industry. Thank you.
Good question. We're looking at how to get greater teeth to sanctions. I think sanctions have effect at different levels. I think although the Security Council process has moved, say, slowly at times, that's not been without effect in that many businesses throughout the world, and this is particularly true of Europe, have seen the writing on the wall, seen that we're heading for a major international crisis around and drawn their own conclusions. So European trade has fallen with Iran. Investment has been, drops in investment have been particularly stark. I mean, I don't think there's been any significant investment from Europe in Iran since President Ahmadinejad came to office. UI identify a number of areas of sanctions. Of course, we've all got menus of options. My understanding is that with the Chinese deal, that it, at this moment it is more of a sort of template for future investment rather than at the sort of stage where people will be considering a significant investment. A lot of people have spoken about the potential impact of imposing exports on imposing restrictions on exports of refined products to Iran. I think that clearly is a vulnerability for the country. I think, if memory recalls, they only meet 60% of their own capacity. I would say that during the summer we saw a very interesting situation where once the country introduced petrol rationing, they had Iranians burning down petrol stations and protesting against the government. I think when we apply sanctions, we need to be smart. We want to try and avoid the situation where we are being blamed for problems that the government is causing. I think in our case, that might be an area where we should be cautious about touching. But I do think that we need to think very seriously, and my Prime Minister has said this, about the sort of sanctions we might apply against the oil and gas industry. We think that we should look very carefully at some sort of targeted ban on investment in the oil and gas sector, details still to be worked out. But I think that would send a very powerful message to the regime in Tehran that its future revenue stream is going to be affected, and that will worry a lot of people who worry about how they're going to pay the bills and provide jobs for the 800,000 school leavers they have every year, and how they're going to meet those requirements in 5 to 10 years. So, you know, there's a lot of thought going into this. Sanctions are normally most effective if they're applied collectively. It doesn't necessarily mean that they always have to be applied through the Security Council process, but I think, as we all agree, that they should be complementary to that process, and they should add teeth to what we've got.
Chris Schaefer, CNO Resources. I wanted to return to the issue of the possibilities for the next UN Security Council resolution. There's been some noise in town that the end result of that might be a affirmation of the... Can you hear me? Might be sort of merely an affirmation of the earlier resolutions and a referral back to the IAEA, and I'm wondering if you could react to that and what you think it might look like at this time.
Well, I'm not here, and I just quote my French colleague. I think there's another diplomatic rule not to talk about negotiations that are going on, so we won't be able to give any more details on what's talked about in New York. But the impression is that it will be more than the last Security Council resolution. It will not simply be a repetition. And I haven't seen anything of giving the matter back to the IAEA, so I wouldn't speculate too much about that.
I would just like to add one very simple thing about that expression, referring back to the IAEA or returning the issue to the IAEA, just to say that it has no sense. The issue has never left the IAEA Board of Governors. We have two tracks in parallel. What the IAEA has done with its resolution, when? September 05? Was to report the issue to the UN Security Council pursuant to the statute of the agency. But, by the way, the agency is continuing its work in Iran. It has still the whole range of responsibility for implementing its mandate in Iran. Things have not changed. So whatever we do in the UN, the IAEA will continue to have its role. So that expression, referring back or returning to the IAEA, has absolutely no sense. This is a mere slogan that the Iranians are trying to use to confuse people. But in the real life, the IAEA continues on its track, and the UNSC continues on its track, and it will continue to be the same in the foreseeable future.
In back, Rob Siloff.
Gentlemen, in your capacities as your government's representatives in Washington as experts of non-proliferation issues, I think it was a very powerful message that you all gave us, especially on the NIE, that it did not, in your view, change in any way any of the fundamentals in your government's approach to the Iranian nuclear program. Now I'd like to ask you, in your position as diplomats based in Washington that report back to your home capitals, to what extent do you think the NIE has or hasn't altered Washington's view of the Iranian problem? And is it your sense that perhaps those same fundamentals that you find unchanged from your home country's perspective have mistakenly or erroneously been changed here?
And don't try weaseling out that you're not going to tell us what it is that Washington thinks. As Rob points out, you have to report back to your home capitals what it is that Washington thinks. And we just like to have a little bit of the flavor of what kind of perceptions that you may have formed on this matter.
Yes.
Well, I think one lesson of the NIE is you should always be circumspect about revealing your own internal classified communications. I mean, I really defer to, I'd be very happy to listen to any American commentary on what's happened. I read the same, I read the same newspapers as you. I mean, just as a sort of outside observer, it seems that the debate has swung full swing in a week. And this time last week, there was all sorts of frenzied speculation about what this meant for policy internationally. And I now read many more editorials and op-eds in the U.S. press, which are much closer to the line taken by we three today and indeed by our own ministers elsewhere. So I apologize for fudging the question, Rob. But I don't think you'll get more out of my French or German.
Sound better in French.
Bien sûr.
Well, I will interpret that as saying that you feel that the wise words of the Europeans are being heard more in Washington, and that opinion here in Washington seems to have changed, as you said, quite a bit over the last week, and we like to think that we helped shape some of that, but who knows. Simon Henderson.
You've all spoken of the three different parts of what you're concerned about Iran, the enrichment process, the weaponization process, and the missile development. Could you give us a flavor on whether you previously... Nobody's asked the question, but I don't suppose you're going to give the answer, but so I won't. But I'll pass by this question, which is that if the weaponization process stopped in 2003, how far had it got before it stopped in 2003? If they need all these three elements, if you were going to rank them roughly on 1 to 10, with zero being no progress at all and 10 being operational status, where were we? Or were they, if you don't want to put numbers to it, were they all roughly in line? The impression to the layman is that, the layperson is that the missile process was much more developed because we could see that. Those are the pictures we saw. We never saw pictures of the other things. Is that a correct impression or a false impression?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I agree with you that there are three elements in the main concern that we all have. But of course, the one issue on which we have the most objective elements and facts is the first one, the fissile material production program. Then when you try to discuss about the existence or the state of a weapons program, then you enter a very delicate ground. This is really their intelligence stuff. And by principle, we do not even comment our own intelligence assessment, so we do even less comment the intelligence of others. On the missile part, however, two things. On the potential existence of a nuclear weapons program, I completely share your assessment that there are two questions that we really don't know about. And those two questions are if they have halted, as you say, what they were supposedly doing, at what stage did they so? Good question. I have no answer. This is an answer for, this is a question for your intel community. The second question is, how much confidence do you have that you would be able to detect that the Iranians would resume these activities if they were doing so and if they have done so in the past? I don't have any answer, and I'm not entering any kind of supposition on what they did, what they decide, what they are doing now, what they will decide in the future, but there are two questions that are not answered yet on that. The missile question is extremely interesting, too. And same answer, without entering any kind of classified information, we just have to look at what the Iranians are saying. And the Iranian regime itself is claiming that it wants to develop long-range ballistic missile, going much beyond 1,000 kilometers, up to 1,500 kilometers, and even longer, 2,000 kilometers. So we know the trend. And this is not even something related to intelligence. This is what they claim. And then you can ask a very simple question. What for? What is the military sense of such efforts? So I'm sorry to answer questions, your question by new questions. I think it tells you already something about what we think.
I would like to add something relating to your question, because you mentioned as points of concern the enrichment program. Neil has already alluded to the fact that we have a second program in place. That's the heavy water reactor on the plutonium track. And when you look at the uranium enrichment program, it doesn't really make sense, as Nicolas has said. But if you look at the heavy water reactor, it does even make less sense, right? Because what do you want to get out of such a reactor? These are neutrons. It doesn't matter whether they come from a light water research reactor or a heavy water research reactor. But obviously, the Iranians are intent to get such a type 40 megawatt thermal heavy water reactor. Now, going back to facts, simply look around in the world which other countries do have these reactors. List them, and you get the answer. Right? So this is not only the enrichment program. I noticed that in Washington and many parts, people only focus on the enrichment. There is a second track which we should take seriously, and which is as dangerous as the first one.
If I may, the Iranians do have a light water research reactor in Tehran which can produce lots of nutrients. Yeah. You don't need heavy water nutrients.
Patrick, could I...
No, you got one bite of the apple, that's enough. Ion Alexander.
May I ask you a conceptual question? That is to say, how do you really develop a strategy to deal with this challenge? You're focusing, of course, on the nuclear ambition and so on. But shouldn't we have a broader perspective in terms of the role of Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism? Can we separate the two? Are we satisfied, for example, that we were able to cope with the state-sponsored challenge, and now we have to deal only with the nuclear ambition? And I think this is really critical, because if we see the experience of Libya as a state-sponsored terrorism, number one, they renounced resorting to state-sponsored terrorism, and secondly, of course, they ended their nuclear program. So really the question is, from the statecraft perspective, is it realistic to separate the two, or should we look at the total picture?
I think what your question alludes to is, when actually do we have the confidence we need? We have spoken of the fact that we need suspension to regain confidence. And there are many factors that play into that to regain confidence. I don't think that anybody will be able to spell out what exactly are those and establish a list and so that we can check one by one whether this is fulfilled or not. But certainly considerations as those that you have mentioned play a role in that. And this will be a process to see. We have made clear what we expect right from the beginning of confidence-building measures, is suspension, application of the additional protocol, and so on. But this is a process, and we will have to see how far this goes and what is in there and what has to be in there. And certainly your question is a very important one, and I think this will have to be addressed, certainly.
Well, I don't know about you, but I was intrigued by your answer in that... what you're suggesting is that the reestablishing confidence in the peaceful intentions of Iran's nuclear program is also going to factor in some consideration of Iranian actions on broader foreign policy issues, such as its role as a sponsor of terror. And that's an interesting formulation, an interesting way to link the two issues, which I'm not sure that has been highlighted up until now. Rafi Danziger in back. Rafi, why don't you use the microphone behind you?
Rafi Danziger from APAC. One of you said that any new EU sanctions cannot substitute for a third EU resolution. You said it right. For an EU resolution, but will have to complement a UN Security Council resolution. The question is, what happens if no third resolution can be achieved because of Russian and Chinese objections? Then does it mean that the EU stays where it is, or will it then consider further sanctions?
I think you'll get a clearer picture when you see the announcement that will be made tomorrow. But to clarify my point, and I'm very thankful for this question, when I say substitute is, we don't want EU sanctions to damage the United Nations Security Council process. But if we see that that process is not effective, or that we don't have a Security Council resolution, but I have to stress we all agree that we assume there is going to be a third one. But in case it should be 2 weeks or whatever, the EU will take decisions how it will act and react to that. And I think there is a certain amount of consensus that the EU will have to go further than and to act on its own in that respect.
I completely share that assessment. And the fact is that the discussions have already begun within the EU on the different ways we could reinforce these sanctions mechanism. This is all, at the end of the day, this all boils down to a question of cost benefits for the Iranians. And we all share the same assessment that the Iranians are reasonably sensitive to that approach, the cost benefits assessment. What we are trying to do is to increase the cost of what they are doing now. And we can do so through different ways. But as Neil mentioned, we have to be smart in doing so. And what the UNSC brings to the table is the power of the legitimacy of the international community as a whole and the unity of the international community. And we need that. And this is the political side of the sanctions. And as Hans-Peter mentioned, once again, we are on that track. And I don't see why we would not, in the coming weeks, finalize and pass a third UNSC resolution. Then, as we did for the implementation of the 1737 and 47, we would complement, as needed, this third UNSC resolution. We did so in the past. And as Neil reminded you, we did so in a very powerful fashion. We did that at EU level, because there are a certain number of measures that, legally speaking, we can take only at EU level. And we did so, at least our three countries, and many other European countries, at national level. And I don't see any reason why we should not continue to do that. But these all things have to be thought through together. And I fully share Hans-Peter's assessment. We will continue on these different tracks, because they have to go hand in hand.
David Pollack.
Thank you. Dave Pollack, Washington Institute. I think if I understood you, all three of you said that there is still time and room for maneuver both on the sanctions track and on the negotiations track. And I understand pretty well, I think, what you have in mind when you're speaking of the sanctions track. What I would ask you to clarify is what room for maneuver can you imagine on the negotiations track with Iran?
I think there's two elements to this. I think one is I think essentially a public diplomacy job of making clearer what the carrots are on the table, which I think we haven't done well. Some of that we can simply do through public statements. One of the great advantages we have with dealing with Iran is it's an open society. It's a regime that takes extraordinary interest in everything that's said about it around the world. As a sort of the deputy head of mission in Tehran, I was constantly summoned for some offence that the editor of the Yorkshire Post or the Scotsman or newspapers which I had never read in my life had committed by writing some article about Iran on page 32 of a newspaper. That is a great advantage, and we need to turn it to our advantage. And I'm not sure that we as Europeans or others have really thought that through. And so, as I said in my opening remarks, I think in the next 3 months we need to do a really major blitz on that. And that's a job for governments, but I think it's also a job for people interested in policy like yourselves. I think we can take it for granted that the Iranians have read everything the Near East Institute has read this week. They have a large file on Dr. Patrick Clawson, and so they should. And we need to think much more creatively about that. I think we need to have a collective discussion about that. And we've been very good at coming up with ideas, but been less good at delivering them. The next thing is to look at is how we actually engage with Iranians ourselves. For the last year, Solana has been taking the lead in that. We've had various different formats over the years. We had the E3, we had political directors, we had ministers. Kislyak, the Russian deputy foreign minister, has joined us on occasions. we'll need to think again about whether we can sort of play with format in a way which proves attractive to the Iranians. But I think our sort of, if I were to summarize the sort of the catchphrase of how we go about this, I think we can afford to be flexible over process. We can afford to do a little dance if we calculate that it will help get the Iranians into substantive negotiations. But we want to be absolutely rigid on substance, and the substance remains that Iran must suspend all its enrichment-related program activities for substantive negotiations to begin. So I think we, you know, I can't give you a detailed answer because it's something we would discuss as six. But I think at every stage of this process, when we had a Security Council resolution, we thought about little tricks to try and get the Iranians back into negotiations. We haven't pulled it off yet, but we keep going. And it's a hard problem. If there was a magic solution out there, no one has yet told me.
Sir.
Avi Davidi. My question is with regard to Iran's neighboring countries. How would you describe their position when it comes to the behind-the-scene cooperation with the Europeans and the U.S.? Do they cooperate? Do you think that they are nervous? Do you think that they are opposing sanctions, supporting your positions? I would really appreciate each of you, maybe.
So any comments about how neighboring countries help support or complicate your neighboring countries, Iran, that is, help support or complicate your diplomatic efforts regarding Iran?
The only thing you can talk about are facts in that respect. I won't give any assessment on that, but if you look, for example, at the United Arab Emirates, they have passed an export control law that has effect on trade with Iran, and they actually intercepted contraband towards Iran in November. So you see that these states are doing something to implement their obligations under the Security Council resolution. And this, of course, is something positive which we welcome.
Just to answer it more generally, I think one of the things that's changed very much since the Lebanon conflict last summer is that the regional dynamic has changed. And I think that you see heightened concern among the majority of the Arab countries about both the nature of Iranian policies in terms of its support for militias around the region and its ambitions to be the regional hegemon on terms which they don't like. So I think we've seen a hardening of Arab attitudes. Arab governments, as anyone who's worked in government knows, tend to do more things privately than they do publicly. You see the odd glimpse that Arab governments' attitudes have changed in the way that the Arabic press now talks about Iran. 2 years ago, Ahmadinejad, I think, was given quite a sympathetic hearing in much of the Arab media. That's not the case any longer. People talk about him in quite critical terms. There's a lot of derogatory references to sort of Persians, Safavids crept in. I think that that's indicative, I think, of the nervousness at the top of Arab governments. But I think it's the nature of dealing with countries in the region. They prefer to keep their actions below the radar screen rather than above it. Is that the right phrase, below the radar screen? You know what I mean.
Yes. Sir.
Alan Brown with the Canadian Embassy. Continuing with the theme of neighboring countries, do you get this sense that neighboring countries are growing increasingly nervous by Iran's continuing enrichment for uranium and its second track on the plutonium side, I guess, to the extent that they're also that you see signs that they may be starting to think about doing their own kind of nuclear, setting up their own nuclear programs? Are there proliferation concerns that are developing by the length of time that it's taking for Iran to respond to international pressure?
I would also want to add on to that. The United States government has welcomed the interest of a number of Middle Eastern countries in civilian nuclear power programs. I would be interested in what are your thoughts about proliferation implications of that pursuit of nuclear power by countries who are, a number of whom are quite well endowed, it would seem, with oil and gas reserves.
I won't qualify what the neighboring countries think about Iran and the path it is taking. I mean, this is up to them to do that, especially in public. What I'd like to answer to your questions is slightly different, and is on the second part of your question on the trend of many countries throughout the world to renew and to develop their own nuclear program. And that I'm pretty confident because my president has spoken very clearly and publicly on this issue. As a matter of principle, we favor that kind of trend, and i.e. the development by any countries that thinks it needs so, the development of a program, a civilian nuclear program, the development of the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And there are many reasons for that. There are environmental reasons, and in terms of global warming, I wouldn't dwell on that here, but this is always something which is in our mind. And there are political reasons there. What we say to the Iranians is what we say to any country throughout the world. We are not trying to prevent you from developing the peaceful uses of nuclear energy pursuant to the NPT and to its Article 6 and the whole Article 6, not a pick and choose of the Article 6 and not a pick and choose in the NPT. The Article 4. Thanks. This is my, the influence of my German colleague on Article 6. I'm kidding. On Article 4. So basically the message is the same for any kind of countries. Then the question for us is how we make sure that in helping these countries develop the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, we do that in a completely proliferation-resistant way. There are different proposals that we have put on the table, different elements that we think through to ensure that. I could list the whole of them. There are discussions within the NSG, the Nuclear Suppliers Group, on the way we make sure that no sensitive technology is transferred in countries which are not completely safe and secure. There are reflections throughout the international community, especially in Vienna and the IAEA, on the multinational assurances that we can give to a certain number of countries so as they develop the peaceful uses of nuclear energy without developing the sensitive part of a nuclear program. So basically, from many reasons, we really favor the developments and that trend. But we have to do so in a responsible way and in a proliferation-resistant way. And this is perfectly doable, and this is precisely what my country in particular is doing and has been doing these last weeks, in fact. And this is also a powerful message to the Arab and Muslim world. We don't have anything against these countries developing the peaceful uses energy. On the contrary, we want to help them. But we have to do that in a responsible way. And this is perfectly doable, and this is what we'll continue to do in the coming weeks and years.
Just to add on this will be some of the rare occasions where you see a difference between the positions in France and Germany. We're still phasing out of nuclear energy, so we are not really supportive of nuclear energy anywhere in the world, be it in France or Belgium or any other regions. But Nicolas is absolutely right pointing out to the fact that the major point is non-proliferation, right? So even our minister of a country that's phasing out of nuclear energy has made a proposal to have an enrichment facility on IAEA grounds for the sake of non-proliferation. So if we see these programs, I think the most urgent thing is that they are proliferation safe. And this is what interests us most in that region, if you look at the interest in the region in nuclear energy. And as you have mentioned, this is what we really have to deal with. If they decide on nuclear energy, it's their sovereign decision. We see that, and we have to try and help them to organize things in a way that they are proliferation safely operated. That's the point.
Well, I think that we finally found an issue in which there's some small degree of difference, even if it's about domestic politics of whether or not to use nuclear energy at home. And what we have heard, though, this afternoon is an enormous amount of an agreement between our European colleagues. And I think a remarkably clear answer to the question of what impact the NIE is having on the European approach towards Iran. The answer is precious little, precious little. And for that, I would like to thank our speakers and to thank you and say that, unfortunately, we'll probably be back looking at this issue in the future.